Good morning. President Trump escalates his bid to control the Federal Reserve, seeking to fire a Fed governor who votes on interest rates. She says Trump lacks the legal power to get rid of her without cause. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump's promise to end a war within a day of taking office became a summit on day 208. I'm Ian Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Since then, the peace effort in Ukraine has stalled as Russia backed away. Why hasn't Trump's diplomacy worked? Also, what is Phoenix doing right this summer? Heat-related deaths are trending down this year despite intense heat there. It's Tuesday, August 26th. This day in 1920, the U.S. certified the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which affirmed women's right to vote. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The governor of the Federal Reserve is refusing to step down despite being fired by President Trump last night. In a post on social media, the White House said Lisa Cook was removed effective immediately under Article 2 of the Constitution and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The termination letter cites allegations that Cook made false statements on applications for home mortgages. Cook, who was appointed by former President Joe Biden, has not been charged with any crime. A federal judge has temporarily halted the deportation of a Maryland man detained by ICE. Kilmar Abrego Garcia has been at the center of a legal battle after he was wrongfully deported to El Salvador earlier this year. Wamboy Kamau from member station WYPR reports Abrego Garcia was taken back into custody during an immigration interview on Monday.
Abrego Garcia's legal team says he declined an offer to plead guilty to human smuggling charges in exchange for deportation to Costa Rica. Now, Abrego Garcia faces deportation to Uganda instead. Former DHS official Andrea Flores says this case sends a warning to unauthorized immigrants nationwide.
This case is not just about the injustice that is happening, Mr. Abrego Garcia. They are making an example and showing and attempting to scare every immigrant in this country to self-deport by showing the full force and weight of the federal government can do.
On X, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem said the president won't allow Abrego Garcia to, quote, terrorize American citizens any longer. For NPR News, I'm Wamboy Kamau in Baltimore.
Legal challenges are mounting against the new Texas congressional election map requested by President Trump. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports several groups are claiming the redrawn maps discriminate against Black and Latino voters.
Texas voters, voting rights advocates, and the state's Mexican-American Legislative Caucus are leading at least three lawsuits against the Texas congressional district map recently passed by the Republican-controlled state legislature. If it's used for next year's midterm election, the map could help Republicans win five more seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. First, the map has to face legal claims that it dilutes the collective voting power of Latino and Black voters in the Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth areas. This Republican-led redistricting push has sparked a response amongst Democratic leaders in California, which is set to hold a special election in November to ask voters to allow the state to offset Texas by using a new lawmaker-drawn map that could give Democrats five more House seats. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
President Trump has signed an executive order directing the Justice Department to prosecute people for burning the American flag. The order challenges a Supreme Court decision that protects flag burning as political expression. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Australia says it's expelling the ambassador of Iran and withdrawing diplomatic representation from the country. The Australian government accuses Tehran of being behind at least two attacks on Jewish community targets in Sydney and Melbourne since October of 2023. Reporter Christina Kukula has more.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said Australia's domestic intelligence agency has what he termed credible evidence that Iran directed the attacks in October and December last year. No one was injured in the incidents, which damaged a Sydney restaurant and a synagogue in Melbourne. Albanese says they were attempts to sow discord in the community.
Any attack on our social cohesion is an attack on Australia.
Australia's government says it will also designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organisation. Iran's ambassador and several embassy staff have been given 7 days to leave Australia, which has withdrawn its own diplomatic staff from Tehran. For NPR News, I'm Christina Kukulia in Melbourne, Australia.
Hundreds of thousands of people remain out of their homes in central Vietnam after a powerful typhoon swept across the region on Monday. The storm flooded streets in Hanoi, knocked out power, and closed schools and airports. Heavy rain and landslide warnings remain in effect. Scientists have long warned that climate change has exacerbated regional storms, with countries in the global south facing the worst impacts. Stocks across Asia traded lower today. Dow futures are also down at this hour. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The J.V. Bailey House doesn't have flashing lights or fast-moving cars like the Midway. It doesn't harbor groomed, pampered farm animals, and you can't get any fried, fattening food there. State Fair archivist Carrie Huber says the unassuming structure became the home of the fair's greenhouse superintendent in 1916, 5 years after it was built. He kept track of the plants used on the fairgrounds and kept the grounds safe.
And so instead of paying for a fireman to be there on a night shift, they decided, why don't we have somebody live here year-round?
The only time the superintendent could not stay in his house? During the state fair, when he had to turn it over to the visiting fair board members. The home was renovated into office space for the State Fair Foundation 100 years after the first superintendent moved in.
It still retains that charm that it once had.
The Bailey House is now named for the family that funded the renovation. It's one of two residential buildings remaining on the fairgrounds. Neither houses anyone anymore.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Coming up, how did Phoenix improve the safety of people in the summer heat? First, we report on President Trump's bid to extend his power over independent agencies, including the Federal Reserve.
The president is trying to fire a member of the Federal Reserve Governing Board. Trump makes that move while pressuring the Fed to lower interest rates on his preferred timeline.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley joins us once again. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, the president made this announcement in a social media post regarding Fed Governor Lisa Cook. What's going on?
This is ostensibly a reaction to claims made by Trump ally Bill Pulte, who oversees mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Pulte accused Cook of making false statements on a mortgage application back in 2021, before she joined the Federal Reserve. Pulte says Cook applied for home loans on two different properties, weeks apart, in two different states, and said that each one would be her primary residence, which would typically result in better loan terms. Now, if true, that certainly raises eyebrows. Pulte told CNBC last week he thought it was enough to remove Cook from her post at the Federal Reserve.
I don't know what cause is if that's not cause. I mean, this lady, I don't understand how she can be in charge of setting interest rates for our country, and here she is potentially lying on her applications to get better interest rates.
He says potentially there. So far, this is just an allegation. And Pulte's leveled similar charges at other Trump antagonists like Adam Schiff, the senator from California, Letitia James, the attorney general from New York. The president said in a social media post he does not have confidence in Cook and that that's enough cause to remove her. By law, governors at the central bank can only be removed for cause, which is designed to protect the Fed from political meddling by the White House.
Well, if that's what the law says, what is Lisa Cook saying?
Cook says the president has no authority to fire her, and she's vowing to carry out her duties as a Fed governor. A statement from her attorney, Abby Lowell, says Cook will take whatever actions are necessary to prevent what he called this illegal firing. Democrats are rallying around Cook, who was appointed by former President Biden. For instance, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's the top Democrat on the committee that oversees the Fed, called Trump's effort to remove Cook an authoritarian power grab and said it must be overturned in court.
I'm trying to get the context here, Scott Horsley. We have seen in recent days the Department of Justice go after people the president doesn't like. We know other parts of the federal government have made a point of doing that. The Federal Communications Commission goes to mind, targeting media organizations the president doesn't like. In this case, we have a housing agency that has repeatedly come up with issues with people the president doesn't like. And he's made no secret of the fact that he wants the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. How's this fit in?
Yeah, Trump has really taken a sledgehammer to the protective barriers that are supposed to insulate the Fed. He's been very critical of Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. He's attacked the central bank over cost overruns. If he succeeds in removing Cook from the board, that would create another vacancy for Trump to fill with someone more likely to do his bidding. By the way, economists are virtually unanimous that an independent central bank works better than one that's under the thumb of the president. Just yesterday, the National Association for Business Economics released a survey about this. Courtney Schupert, who's with Macro Policy Perspectives, talked about the results.
Around 95% of economists are concerned about the Federal Reserve's independence being compromised over the next several years.
And 3 out of 4 economists surveyed said the president should play no role in setting interest rates.
Scott, thanks for your insights, as always.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley.
The Federal Reserve is not the only independent federal agency that President Trump is trying to exert greater control over. In May, the Supreme Court said Trump could temporarily remove the heads of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board, both appointed by President Biden, as their legal challenges play out in court. Let's bring in Rohit Chopra, who has experience with 2 independent federal regulators. He served as a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission in the first Trump administration. He also directed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the Biden and Trump administrations until he was fired by President Trump in February of this year. So, Rohit, what do you make of the president saying he intends to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook?
Well, for months, the White House has been haunting the Fed, looking to push out members of the board, including its chairman, Jay Powell. This is part, as you noted, of a broader trend to try and make these independent watchdogs essentially into obedient lapdogs. And I think when it comes to the Fed, the stakes are very high. Americans are really worried about higher prices in the grocery stores, and new college grads are struggling to find jobs. This is going to even make it more worrisome, because none of this takeover is going to really help the economy.
You think it's a campaign of terror, so to speak, to get people to bend to his will?
Well, I think this is part, as you note, of a series of actions. When President Trump fired me, the Supreme Court made it clear that for years it was okay to do that. But there are some agencies and members that are off limits. And everyone knows that he is willing to push the edge and cross the line when it comes to those laws if it serves his own agenda.
What would be the ramifications of moves like this, especially when it comes to things like the Federal Trade Commission?
Well, it's hard to say. We know that when it comes to the Federal Reserve or the Federal Trade Commission, that means that oversight of the markets could become much more uncertain. That could result in higher prices, that could result in financial instability, and that can mean picking winners and losers based on their political ideology rather than the law itself.
The oversight would be uncertain, or would it be just something that really wouldn't exist? Would it? I mean, it would be more of what the president would want as opposed to what an independent agency would determine is okay.
That's right. Independent agencies, they're supposed to enforce the law fairly without looking at those political affiliations. And we have seen at some of these agencies, he's looked to take over. He's essentially shuttered the enforcement. And many of those companies are now looking for ways to make him happy to avoid scrutiny.
I know that you know Governor Cook personally. I'm wondering if you've spoken with her at all since the president began targeting her and how she might be feeling about things.
Well, look, Governor Cook is saying that she will fight this. This is a massive breach that has no precedent. And if she can be removed, then so can every single other member. So we'll see how this plays out. The court has drawn a line that Federal Reserve Board members are in a different category. And again, the stakes are pretty high when it comes to our broader economy.
But why shouldn't a president have more control over an agency such as the FTC or the Federal Reserve?
Well, that's just not what the law says. The law established some of these agencies to make sure that they were fairly enforcing the law, that they would not be subjected to unnecessary political interference, and that companies with lots of political power who make political contributions wouldn't be able to lobby themselves out of accountability. And of course, independent central banks that make decisions about interest rates based on data, that's really key. And we don't see a path where the president taking over this board is really going to help people who are struggling.
One more thing quickly. What's it like to be fired by Donald Trump? Is it as theatrical as it was on The Apprentice?
Well, that was entertainment, but this is people's real lives. This is a real economy that we're dealing with, not just a network television show searching for ratings.
Rohit Chopra, former Federal Trade Commissioner, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thank you very much for your thoughts on this.
Thanks again.
Arizona has had another extremely hot summer. It's Arizona. But around Phoenix, heat-related deaths are on track to decline this year. Here's Catherine Davis-Young of our member station KJZZ.
Metro Phoenix has seen heat-related deaths rise dramatically over the last decade. In 2014, there were 61 deaths. In 2024, there were 608. The increase has coincided with rising temperatures and growth of Phoenix's homeless population. Mark Labario does street outreach with Phoenix Rescue Mission. He sees firsthand how unhoused people struggle in the heat.
Being depleted from like food and then sleep and not really resting, and then you got addiction on top of it, or alcohol. It's just a recipe for just disaster. People dying out there, just people are just dying out there.
The heat is taking a devastating toll again this summer, with 44 deaths confirmed so far and 408 under investigation. But those numbers are about 18% lower than at the same point last year. Dr. Nick Staub is chief medical officer for Maricopa County. He says it's too early to draw conclusions.
With this many cases still under investigation, there's a lot that could still happen.
Last year, the county saw a slight year-over-year decrease in heat deaths in spite of record temperatures. Another drop this year could point to a positive trend. Staub says if it is a trend, it could be thanks to city and county investments in heat relief, like more cooling centers, which are open at more hours of the day across the county.
Just having the extended hours that have been provided over the last couple of summers, I think that that is a useful tool, and we're seeing it bear out in lower numbers.
And ER Dr. Frank Lavecchio at Phoenix's Valleywise Health thinks first responders and hospitals have gotten better at treating heat illnesses in the last few years.
We're getting a better understanding of who needs to stay, who needs to get admitted, who needs to get IV fluids a little bit more aggressively.
The county won't release a final report on heat-related deaths until early next year. Even if deaths decline, climate change continues to make summers hotter, homelessness continues to increase, and the pandemic-era federal funding that's paid for many of Phoenix's heat relief programs is set to expire in 2026. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
She's a reporter at one of our NPR stations, which are in communities across this country, run by people in the community, supported by people in the community. This is NPR News.
KPXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
R comes from this station. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at easycater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Anna Mae Martinez. President Trump and his confirmed nominee for D.C.'s top prosecutor, Jeanine Pirro, have both called for minors as young as 14 to be charged as adults when they're accused of certain crimes in the nation's capital. But some in the juvenile justice field say that approach to youth crime has been tried before and just does not work. Vincent Schiraldi is among them. He's led corrections agencies in D.C. and New York and most recently resigned as Secretary of Juvenile Services in Maryland amid criticism of his leadership of the department. Schiraldi spoke with our colleague, Michelle Martin.
Washington, D.C.'s juvenile incarceration rate is about three times the national average. So it's not like D.C. is coddling kids, and it's not like D.C. has an extraordinary amount of crime by juveniles.
What about the rest of the country? Does the rest of the country have a youth crime problem?
From the year 2000 to the year 2020, juvenile arrests declined by 80% in the country. This happened at the same time as there was a 75% decline in the number of kids being locked up. And it was probably synergistic, right? We locked fewer kids up, we put more kids in programs, so we locked fewer kids up again. So there's probably a virtuous cycle there. Some of that also occurred in Washington, D.C. Then we have a pandemic. We have Black Lives Matter protests. Both of those things, criminologists believe, probably resulted in an uptick in crime. A lot of police retired. It was hard to hire cops. But also, schools went away. Mentors went away. All of us got emotional during that period of time. So crime went up amongst everybody. It went up amongst juveniles for a few years. And now we're starting to see a curve back down nationally in juvenile crime and in Washington, D.C.
Do you think there's something about when very young people are involved in crime that it just grabs the public's attention?
The credo of your profession is that if a dog bites a man, that's not news, but if a man bites a dog, that's news. In Baltimore, there was a study done recently by the Sentencing Project. 5% of the arrests in Baltimore are juveniles, but on the Fox affiliate in Baltimore, 53% of their coverage of crime involved juveniles. And so it is more unusual when a young person, and it should be, commits a violent crime. And so it does get more attention. And I think that unless you've personally been the victim of crime, you know a lot of what you know about crime from the media, often evening news or social media that hypes this stuff up. And that makes people afraid. That matters. It really matters how people feel. Because the more people that are engaged in the community, the safer that community is going to be. And again, you have the opportunity to create a virtuous cycle. Part of the problem, the thing that worries me about what President Trump is doing, is he's scaring the bejesus out of people in the Washington, D.C. area and anyone who might want to come here.
this notion of trying kids as adults, as I understand it, like in the 90s, there was another renewed push to try kids as adults. How did that work out?
The research on it finds it extremely negative. Several really high-quality studies were done, and the people who are tried as adults get arrested more frequently and for more violent crimes than the similar kids who are retained in a juvenile system.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, the juvenile system's imperfect, but at least we're trying on the juvenile system to rehabilitate kids. Everybody, for example, in my facilities goes to school all the time. You really don't have to go to school when you're in an adult prison. We had programs, after-school programs, basketball leagues, aftercare. A lot of that stuff really doesn't exist for adults. What we do with young people during that period of time really can set them on the trajectory one way or the other. You put them in adult prisons, and you're kind of writing a script for them.
What is a more effective approach to intervening in these negative cycles?
One is, most of the violent crime comes at the hands of very few people. And so if you can focus deterrence and services and supports on that 2%, that really can help. But then there are other parts of the system for young people, particularly summer jobs or after-school programs. Most youth crime occurs between 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock. That's when kids are off school and their parents aren't home yet. So couldn't we productively occupy kids during that period of time? What is happening nationally? The president cut hundreds of millions of dollars in crime prevention programs just like this for all around the country.
Vincent Schiraldi has headed juvenile services in Washington, D.C. and Maryland and probation and corrections in New York City. He starts as a visiting fellow with the Pinkerton Foundation in September. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Steve, last night before the show started, I went for a jog, and I rounded a corner, and right there in the middle of the street, a couple of coyotes taking a nap.
Wow!
Right there. When they noticed me, they got up, moved to the sidewalk, I walked past them, and went home.
Amazing!
Those are the coyotes in L.A.
Okay, they're just like hanging out. They weren't worried about you. You weren't too worried about them.
And they were courteous, apparently, because they moved aside.
Very polite. Excuse me, sir, after you. Well, coyotes are in the news, it turns out, and also in the sights of hunters in Michigan. After a long debate, the Michigan Natural Resources Commission says it is committed to extending coyote hunting season all year long.
Yeah, Justin Tomei is with Michigan United Conservation Clubs, a group focused on protecting people's right to hunt fish and trap.
Coyotes exist in all 83 counties in Michigan, so their populations are booming. They are doing extremely well here in Michigan.
Tomei argues year-round hunting can manage population growth and lets farmers protect land and livestock. Naomi Lush-Warren disagrees. She's a scientist for Humane World for Animals, a nonprofit specializing in animal protection.
What we know about coyote ecology is that coyotes are very good at reproducing very, very fast. And the fewer coyotes there are, the faster they reproduce. So really, we've got a lot of evidence to prove that the more you hunt them, you're really not reducing the population.
And when you kill one, she says,
you destabilize a pack that relies on each other. And when they're destabilized, they might go for easier prey. And easier prey includes farm animals, pets, etc.
Okay, so that's a counterargument, but data from Michigan's Department of Natural Resources indicates year-round hunting will not significantly affect the state's coyote population either way. Lush-Warren says the reality might be less certain.
Nobody counts coyotes. The only numbers we get are from hunters telling us how many they killed.
I suppose we will find out more about that in days to come, and we'll cover it here on NPR Now.
New Orleans' 9th Ward was one of the area's hardest hit by Hurricane Katrina. 2 decades later, this neighborhood is still in an uphill battle to recover.
This is not a third world country. This is New Orleans. No, we're only 10 minutes from the French Quarters, and the people that's here in the lower 9th Ward, they're still suffering.
I'm Elsa Chang, the ongoing fight to save the 9th Ward on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 529. In just a moment, our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. And coming up at 720, it's John's full phonology report. He'll let you know what he's been seeing in nature this past week. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid 70s, overnight lows in the low 50s. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. You can answer our question of the week. What were your favorite books to read as a child or books to read to a child? Text us 218-326-1234. The Central Lakes College Ag and Energy Research Center has its annual field day this Friday from 9 to 3 at their site in Staples. It's a day of hands-on demonstrations, education sessions, local food, and more. Find a schedule at clcagandenergy.org/events. The last Summer Muse Festival of the season is this Saturday from 4 to 8 at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji with artists, musicians, food vendors, and more. And you can learn all about bats at the Sac Sim Bog this Saturday from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will be both indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration required. Learn more at saczim.org/events. The KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout our region, from Park Rapids to Palo, Talmoon to Reamer, Black Duck to Crosby, and more. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at kaxe.org. And you can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of every month at 9:30. Hikes are 1 hour long. Dogs are welcome on a leash. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, August 26th in the year 2001, I note that the ragweed has begun to bloom. Oftentimes, ragweed is ignored for just about all of the year. And then, all at once, in the fall, people who are sufferers of hay fever find that there is an unbelievable amount of irritation for their nose, and most of it comes from ragweed. Oftentimes, people are quick to point to the goldenrod and say, it's the goldenrod pollen. But if you look at the pollen of both the ragweed and the goldenrod under a microscope, the goldenrod pollen is innocuous and tiny compared to the ragweed pollen. The ragweed pollen looks like one of those spiky balls that you saw in medieval warfare, those giant balls with spikes all over them. And that's essentially what ragweed pollen looks like under a microscope. And you can imagine what that might feel like if you inhaled a bunch of it and if your nose were extra sensitive to that kind of an irritation. So don't blame the goldenrod. It's the ragweed that's blooming right now. And if you are sensitive to pollen and to hay fever, no doubt you know that already.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. President Trump says he's not done trying to end the war in Ukraine.
I'm interested in stopping a war where last week 7,109 soldiers died, both Russian and Ukraine. Such a waste of life and humanity.
We're not sure where the president got that exact number yesterday, although thousands and thousands and thousands have died in Ukraine. And that dying continues despite the president's high-profile summit with Vladimir Putin welcoming the Russian president in Alaska a few days ago. Since then, Russia has been slow-walking any potential peace deal and backing away from commitments that Trump claims they made. NPR's Russia correspondent Charles Maines is following all this from Moscow. Hi there, Charles.
Morning.
So when you evaluate everything that's happened, has there been any measurable progress toward peace?
Well, you know, critics would say that Putin got a literal red carpet reception in Alaska and Trump got nothing in return. No ceasefire deal, no immediate concessions from Putin, all while backing off of threats of new sanctions. And yet, there were these hints by Trump and Putin in Alaska that a deal was in the offing. Key to that, Trump and his team said Putin had agreed to some form of Western security guarantees for Ukraine. If robust enough, in other words, with the U.S. backing, the thinking here was that those protections could unlock a more sensitive issue for Ukraine, whether to accept territorial concessions as part of any peace deal, as Moscow is demanding. So, you know, in that line, Trump's gambit looked at least possible, even more so after Trump said Putin had agreed to meet with Zelensky and possibly Trump himself to finally hash out the terms, or so it seemed. It seemed to hit a wall, a brick Kremlin wall, to be specific.
I've been following this a little bit. It seems the Kremlin has reworded what they supposedly agreed to. What are their objections?
Well, you know, Russia's official line is that it supports Trump's peace efforts, but Moscow has repeatedly sought to slow them down, including this meeting between Putin and Zelensky. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was on NBC's Meet the Press this weekend. Let's listen.
Putin is ready to meet with Zelensky. When the agenda would be ready for a summit? And this agenda is not ready at all.
Now, Steve, Lavrov also rejected several proposals for Western security guarantees for Ukraine, for example, the presence of a European peacekeeping force, because Lavrov insists Russia should be part of any group providing security to Ukraine. That did not go over well in Kyiv, and that's now up to the U.S. and Secretary of State Marco Rubio in particular to try and come up with some other solutions that will satisfy all sides.
What is Putin saying?
Well, he hasn't really talked about the Ukraine peace deal since Alaska. Instead, he's praised Trump, as he did during a recent visit to a nuclear research facility last week. Let's listen. So here Putin says that ever since Trump's return to the White House, he's seen a light at the end of the tunnel in restoring relations with Washington, adding the two sides were already discussing joint projects in the Arctic and Alaska. And this has really been the Russian playbook when it comes to Trump, offering the prospect of lucrative deals or progress on bilateral issues like arms control, rather than hinging the relationship on whether or not there's peace in Ukraine. Because fundamentally, Russia sees Trump as wanting to end the war, but not so concerned about the fine print, you know, for example, where boundaries are ultimately drawn, that he would reject deals elsewhere. And that's something Moscow thinks it can play to its advantage as these negotiations and the war drag on.
I'm just listening to your words there, Charles, quoting Putin, that Putin sees a light at the end of the tunnel in restoring relations with Washington as opposed to bringing peace to Ukraine, different goals.
Absolutely different goals. And it seems that he's trying to bifurcate the two.
NPR's Charles Maines, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on the president's attempts to jumpstart diplomacy between Russia and Ukraine, let's turn now to David Sanger. He's a longtime White House and national security correspondent for the New York Times and wrote this week about Trump's, quote, strategic incoherence over the past 2 weeks. So, David, what do you think it is about President Trump that maybe he doesn't want to either understand or refuse to accept about Vladimir Putin's resolve when it comes to Ukraine?
Well, I think the place where it starts is that the president says that Putin is seeking peace. He may ultimately want peace, but I don't think he wants peace necessarily on the same timeline that the president has in mind here, because at this point, delay works to his advantage. He feels as if his troops were advancing, that there's no reason to give up now. But the strategic incoherence goes deeper than that. The fundamental problem is that the administration keeps changing the way it discusses the United States' role in this. Sometimes you hear President Trump and J.D. Vance, the vice president, talk about the U.S. as a mediator. In other words, they're first talking to Putin, then they're talking to Zelensky, yeah. Then they're trying to come up with some ideas in between, the sort of traditional diplomacy. At other moments, you hear the president say, well, the United States would join in the security arrangements for Ukraine or would continue some kind of military support for Ukraine, even if it's through the Europeans, in which case the U.S. is contributing to Ukraine's side. And at other moments, of course, we've heard the president repeat the Russian talking points.
So could it be that Vladimir Putin sees what the United States or how they're handling it and saying, hey, they don't seem to have their act together, so I can wait this out?
Or they don't really know what they want. They just want a solution that would get the president to his ultimate goal here, which he's declared is win a Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, in the story, I said, you know, there's kind of a model here for the president. It's what Teddy Roosevelt did 120 years ago this week in the Russo-Japanese War, where he did, in fact, play mediator in that particular case because the U.S. didn't have the kind of interest it has right now in Ukraine and in Ukraine at least holding on as an independent state. Yeah. And he did win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906, the next year.
David, you've written that Trump leans on leader-to-leader charm. Why do you think that doesn't seem to work with Vladimir Putin?
Well, it's not just Putin it doesn't work with. And, you know, Putin's pretty good at this, and obviously former KGB agent, you've heard the whole bit. He knows how to go play President Trump and other leaders. But think back to the closest model in this in the first Trump term. It was President Trump's relationship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who he continued to praise yesterday while sitting in the Oval Office with the president of South Korea, right? And he talked about what a great relationship he had with Kim Jong-un. Well, it's terrific that they've got a good relationship, but what did that alone get him? He went and met him in Singapore, said we're on the way to disarming North Korea. Within 6 months, they would begin giving up nuclear weapons. They never gave up a single nuclear weapon, yeah. And then they built more than they've ever had before.
That's David Sanger of the New York Times. David, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:42. Thanks for listening to KAXE in the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible, and you can save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details, or visit kaxe.org and click on Give. Thanks so much for your support. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid 70s, with lows tonight in the low 50s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny and a bit warmer, highs 75 to 80, slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Grand Rapids River Fest is Saturday, September 6th. We are getting ready to welcome Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. You can find information about those artists and more about the event and get your tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6. Races begin at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities with registration at 8. Proceeds benefit the United Way School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. For more information, visit uwlakes.org/lumberjack. Coming up at about 6:45, our talkback segment. Let us know what you've been seeing in nature. Text 218-326-1234.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know who listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out.
and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
Station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. This next story, like so many involving President Trump, is a rerun from the 1980s. The president developed many of his views in the 1980s when he was a real estate developer in New York. His trade policy, much of his rhetoric, is familiar to people who are around in the 80s. And that is true of the president's call to punish people who burn the American flag, a matter that the Supreme Court ruled on in the 80s.
All over the country, they're burning flags. All over the world, they burn the American flag. And as you know, through a very sad court, I guess it was a 5-4 decision, they called it freedom of speech.
As they did. Let's bring in the president of the National Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you recall that ruling by the Supreme Court in 1989?
I recall it very well. I was in law school, and in fact, I wrote my law school note about that ruling. So I thought about nothing more than that ruling in 1989.
Did you argue that the 5-4 ruling was appropriate?
I sure did. And I was especially moved by the fact that Justice Antonin Scalia agreed. He had a great line a few years later. He said, if it were up to me, I would put in jail every sandal-wearing, scruffy, bearded weirdo who burns the American flag. But then he added, I'm not a king. And that inspiring statement by the conservative Justice Antonin Scalia convinced me and the Supreme Court and lots of other people that it's the pillar of our constitutional tradition that you can't punish expressive conduct merely because it's offensive.
Now, I'm just remembering, this was a ruling about a law that banned flag burning, right?
Exactly. It started off with a Texas law that banned flag burning. A guy called Gregory Johnson was prosecuted, and the Supreme Court struck that down in 1989. But Congress wasn't willing to rest, so it passes a law the next year banning flag desecration at the federal level, and the Supreme Court strikes that down again in 1990. Both of those decisions were 5-4. There were dissents, including by Chief Justice Rehnquist. But most people think that this Roberts Court would affirm the protections for flag burning. Even Justice Alito has cited the decision sympathetically, although Justice Thomas has questioned it. And that's why, for all those reasons, it's one of those laws that everyone expects to stay. And the president's executive order doesn't squarely challenge it. It basically says that if you burn the flag in a way that otherwise violates the law, such as possibly inciting imminent violence, then you can be prosecuted. But the Supreme Court said that flag burning by itself doesn't threaten imminent violence. So essentially, it's possible that he's inviting a challenge to Texas v. Johnson. Mm-hmm. He does suggest that notwithstanding the Supreme Court's rulings on First Amendment protections, the executive order says, it's appropriate to pursue litigation to clarify the scope of the First Amendment exceptions to this area. That might be an exception to revisit the case.
So working around the edges, this reminds me of some other executive orders that tell agencies to do illegal things to the maximum extent permissible by law. In other words, it's not really an order about anything. In a couple of seconds, does this feel like a distraction from other matters then?
Well, I think it does. It's symbolic, but it's not likely to have practical effect unless you burn the flag and try to incite violence at the same time, which is not likely to happen.
Okay. Jeffrey Rosen is president of the National Constitution Center, also, by the way, author of an upcoming book, The Pursuit of Liberty, How Hamilton versus Jefferson Ignited the Lasting Battle Over Power in America. Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old-school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums, she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. See you September 6th.
Everyone should pay attention to an attempted firing of one of America's central bankers.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. This back-to-school season, a password manager can help students and teachers log in securely across all accounts and devices. Bitwarden.com. And by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, invoicing, and more to help entrepreneurs manage their finances. Learn more at Mercury.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. Based on unproven allegations, President Trump last evening moved to fire a governor of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve. The Fed governor, Lisa Cook, says the president does not have the authority to fire her and plans to stay on. In social media posts last week, Trump had claimed without evidence that there was fraud on a mortgage once taken out by Cook. One of the strengths of the U.S. financial system has been a central bank that is not beholden to the impulses of politicians. Karen Petru watches the Fed closely as founder of Federal Financial Analytics in Washington. Morning.
Good morning.
I want to ask you, do Federal Reserve governors like Lisa Cook serve at the pleasure of the president of the United States? Like, for instance, the president's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. The president could certainly fire that position. But what about a Fed governor?
No, the president cannot fire any member of the Federal Reserve Board at will. The only way the law allows the president to fire members of the Federal Reserve Board, including the chair, is for cause. And that means there has to be malfeasance or gross negligence for that to happen. The allegation here is that Lisa Cook committed mortgage fraud. But that is completely unproven, and therefore the extent to which there is cause is at best dubious.
And one would expect some sort of formal process to determine whether or not Lisa Cook is at fault in some way.
I like to think the United States, where you're innocent until proven guilty, even for cause allegations. What happened last week was there was an unproven allegation posted on Twitter by a government official. He called for a Justice Department criminal investigation. The next day, another official announced that he had found, essentially, that he had found Ms. Cook guilty. Clearly, the day between an assertion posted on Twitter and the next day when a Justice Department official says fire her, there is no investigation. There's no due process.
The overarching issue here, I think, is central bank independence. It sounds like an abstract topic for a high school debate competition. But why should my friend Jeff, a carpenter from Manchester, New Hampshire, or my Aunt Vicky, a nurse, why should they care?
First of all, I think we should all care about the integrity of the process. Congress intended the Federal Reserve to be insulated from politics because of the danger of political decision-making on so important an economic force. More importantly, Congress set up the Federal Reserve Board to be insulated from presidential authority because its independence is critical to credibility.
One can imagine, to pick up on your point there, that it would be of concern to market professionals if a standoff emerges at the Fed. The president saying, you're fired. Federal Reserve governor saying, I'm still here. Whatever the next move is next by either side, this can start to look not like the United States, but what you sometimes see in other countries.
It can, and that's going to cost us all a lot, not just in those of us with funds in the stock market, not those of us looking to buy a house a little bit down the road. This is all really costly. But the dollar right now is the global reserve currency, and that floats the government's boat. Because the world trusts us, they give us their money and invest it in treasury securities for a lot less than is demanded of higher-risk countries. The president has just made us a higher-risk country.
All right. We'll keep watching this. Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics, based in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
At the moment, stock index futures are a little changed as financial players digest the news out of the White House and the Fed. Bonds are down, pushing the 10-year interest rate up 4.29%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the cars, trucks, and vans that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks. More at progressivecommercial.com. And by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com.
Now, beyond our top story about central bank independence and a Trump move to fire a Fed governor, there's actual Federal Reserve policy, which seems on course to lower interest rates slightly 3 weeks from tomorrow. That was the indication from a big central bank symposium the other day. Lower rates will be welcomed by people looking to buy a house. But here's the thing. The Fed doesn't directly control mortgage rates. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
The Fed controls the federal funds rate, the short-term interest rate banks charge each other for overnight loans. It does not control the interest rate paid on longer-term government debt, like the 10-year Treasury note.
And the mortgage rates are affected much more by the 10-year interest rates than like the very short-term interest rates.
Amir Kermani is a real estate professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. He says Fed rate cuts do put downward pressure on longer-term rates, but investor worries about America's ability to pay that debt in the future can keep those rates elevated.
Unless we have some reaction in those longer-term interest rates, I mean, the mortgage rates perhaps are going to stay where they are.
Mortgage rates are also an expectation game. Economist Kara Ng at Zillow says because the Fed has been hinting at easing monetary policy for a little while now, mortgage rates already partially reflect that.
A lot of that information on what the Fed's going to do in September is already priced in. So just because the Fed is likely going to cut interest rates in their September meeting does not mean the mortgage rate is going to fall.
Ng says even if mortgage rates do drop in the future, it's no guarantee the frozen housing market will defrost. Prices are still high and broader economic uncertainty is sidelining many buyers. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. You can make a donation there, and you can also read and listen to lots of local news stories and conversations from our morning show. Weather for today, mostly sunny, high 71 to 76, and lows tonight in the low 50s. For